Week. Sean Thomas continues My Life in Houses by Margaret Forster. It's 1963 and Forster and her husband are living in the wreck of a house they've bought near Hampstead Heath. Until now they've had the place to themselves, but with the return from America of their sitting tenant, the idyll is shattered.
Up until the arrival of Mrs. Hall, it had been easy to forget that the top floor of our house was lived in by someone else. Sharing a house with her turned out to be not at all like sharing with Mrs. Woodcock and Mr. Elton. Mrs. Hall did not flit silently up and down the shared staircase as Mr. Elton had done. For a woman in her mid-60s, a small, slight woman, she was surprisingly heavy on her feet. She clearly liked her passage through the house to be noted, pausing often to sigh or groan in a highly theatrical way. Mrs. Hall's daughter in America bought her a television. In 1963, televisions were not at all common. We didn't have one ourselves, and she invited her friends to come and watch in the evenings. We then had a procession of excited elderly women hauling themselves up the stairs, who then settled down to watch this modern marvel, with the sound turned up to top volume. It was directly over our bedroom, and we'd lie there fuming. For 5 years, we learned to tolerate Mrs. Hall. But in March 1964, I had my first baby, Caitlin, and instantly Mrs. Hall changed character. The television was no longer blaring away, for fear it might waken the baby. And she began tiptoeing up and down the stairs, shushing her friends too. By the time Caitlin was 15 months and able to crawl upstairs, Mrs. Hall tempted her up to her flat every day. This was excellent news for me, especially once I was pregnant again and welcomed the rest I could have while she was with Mrs. Hall. Jake was born in May 1966. As far as we could find out, the first baby ever to be born in the house. I loved this fact. Unable to resist a sentimental gesture to mark the occasion, we planted a cherry tree in the garden. It made me begin to decide that we could never leave this house, our house. How could we, when we'd planted a tree and needed to watch it mature? The thought was there in the back of my mind. I am not going to want to leave this house, ever. If Heath Villas had brought us luck, there were signs by 1966 that Boscastle Road was going to be even luckier for us. The next 2 years were hectic, with film projects on the go. My second novel, Georgie Girl, was in production, and Hunter's Here We Go Round the Mulberry Bush was on the edge of the same. Our house during this period became a place of meetings, directors, producers and actors. Mrs. Hall loved all this activity. Though she said she was hard of hearing, she somehow managed to hear our doorbell ring before I did, and would rush down, arthritic limbs suddenly nimble, and answer the door. I was relieved that by the time Hunter was doing the Beatles biography, Mrs. Hall was in America again for another 6 months. Answering the door to the Fab Four would have had her swooning. Why exactly the Beatles wanted to come to our house never seemed clear to me. But Hunter insisted it was part of wanting, at the height of their fame and already tired of it, to do normal things. Anyway, three of them came separately, though I'd rather have got the whole thing over in one go. Paul came first, with Jane Asher, but for tea, not dinner. Paul played energetically with Jake, and Jane charmed Caitlin. Next came George and Patty. George was intent on a philosophical discussion, and not much interested in the food. I'd been told all the Beatles were vegetarian, and made an aubergine dish for Ringo and Maureen, but it turned out they were the sort of vegetarians who didn't like vegetables other than potatoes. Luckily, I'd made two puddings. John, in the end, didn't come, having got over any desire to do the middle-class thing. When Mrs. Hall returned from her visit to her daughter in America, sure that it would be her last, we took the news badly. The time had surely come. Either Mrs. Hall had to go, or we did. Maybe now we could persuade her to move out. The plan was to buy a flat for her to rent from us at the same rate as she was already paying, and which would be hers to rent for the rest of her life. We could tell that she was keen on the idea, realising perfectly well that the 38 stairs up to her flat in our house were soon going to be too much for her. Negotiations began, and eventually the deal was done. There I was, in the early 70s, serene in my house. Flora was born in October 1972. Soon after, I'd finished my first attempt at a biography of Bonnie Prince Charlie. Our house was full and busy. But the house, in 3 years' time, was about to change its meaning for me, to become a refuge in a manner I'd never imagined. It is too dreary to catalogue all the details of the cancer which resulted in a mastectomy in April 1975. Arriving home was in itself a healing process, and that's how the house changed its significance for me. It took on a magical quality. If I stayed in my house, I'd be safe. I knew perfectly well that this was fanciful nonsense, but it was how I felt. Sometimes, in the weeks that followed, I'd be out on the heath enjoying a walk when I'd be overwhelmed with an urgent need to be inside my house. I'd start walking more quickly, then almost run, and when I reached our front door, my hand would fumble with the key in my haste to get into the house. Once inside, I'd stand for a moment with my back against the door, and the ordinary sight of the staircase ahead of me, a toy dropped halfway up, a basket of clean clothes lying on the bottom stair, waiting to be taken up, all this would calm me. I was fine again, cocooned by the familiarity of the house. We were out of London all the school holidays in Carlisle, visiting our parents. Neither my parents nor my mother-in-law could put all five of us up, so eventually we bought a tiny one-up, one-down cottage outside Colbeck, 12 miles from Carlisle. It was a wreck, far more of a wreck than Boscastle Road had been. Built in the 18th century, it was said to have been lived in by the famous huntsman, John Peel. It was out on the fells in wild countryside, up a track which, in rain, turned into a bog. No kitchen, no bathroom, a dirt floor, and a hole in the roof. It was exactly what we wanted. We bought the cottage in 1977. The renovations were going to take 6 months, but before they were completed and the cottage was ready to inhabit, I was once more in hospital. In mid-February, when I was feeling strong enough, we decided at long last to go and inspect the Colbeck cottage. It was like going into a fairy tale. Lifting the latch on the wooden door and walking in, I wasn't sure if I was Little Red Riding Hood expecting to see the wolf posing as her granny, or one of the three bears returning home, shocked to see their bowls empty. That first night there was a tremendous wind howling and roaring all around, but the cottage stood firm, not a rattle to be heard. It hunkered down, just as it had done for 200 years, and being inside it felt secure and safe. Back in London, I also loved my house more and more. My ordinary house on an ordinary road on the wrong side of the heath has become special to me. I'd always thought it a bit of nonsense for biographers to argue that visiting the houses their subjects lived in was essential to understanding them. But I gradually changed my mind when I started researching a biography of Elizabeth Barrett Browning. Her various houses each had their own atmosphere, and this atmosphere in turn affected her mood and her poetry. The house which best emphasises the importance to Elizabeth Barrett Browning of the building she lived in was not a whole house at all. Her love for it was passionate. Robert Browning took a year's lease on 6 unfurnished rooms in the Casa Guidi in Florence. The building had once been a palace, and was opposite the side of the San Felice Church. All the rooms, except the kitchen, were huge and high-ceilinged, which made them cool, a great advantage in the summer heat of Florence. I knew all this before I visited, and had a layout clear in my head, but the Casa Guidi still was a surprise. Coming into the building from the street, it seemed so dark, as though all the light and dazzling brightness of Florence had been left behind. The entrance hall to the Brownings' apartment is narrow, and had no particular atmosphere, but then, going on into the drawing room, then the bedroom, everything changed. The drawing room is where she wrote her poetry. It was a room which that day seemed full of shadows, the brilliance of the outside sun filtering through the long windows at an angle but not reaching the corners where anyone could lurk. The bedroom was even more mysterious, the light here subdued. It contains the bed in which Elizabeth gave birth to her only child, a son, and in which she died. It really is an emotional experience to stand there in the half-light, remembering what the Casa Guidi meant to Elizabeth. She was never really happy away from it. It gave her strength. She felt protected within its walls. 5 years later, I felt the power a house can have in the life and work of a writer even more strongly when I researched another biography, this time of Daphne du Maurier. Menabilly, the house on the Gribbin Peninsula in Cornwall, where she lived for 25 years, gave her a physical thrill when first she came across it, hidden as it was among trees. It was a two-storey, long, low house. The walls covered so thickly with ivy that most of the many windows were half obliterated. She thought it looked asleep, and that it had a melancholy air which she wanted to investigate. This reaction, which sounded so fanciful, so fey, made immediate sense to me only when I saw the house. The walk from the house through the woods to the little beach described in Rebecca is intensely quiet, and looking back, the house rapidly disappears, long before the sea is reached, as though it had been spirited away. This was what the secretive Daphne du Maurier had always yearned for, a house to match that part of herself which was the writer. Daphne du Maurier spent a quarter of a century restoring the house, which cost a fortune, knowing and dreading that one day, when the lease was up, she would have to leave it. Reading in her letters about this passion she had for Menabilly, it seemed so exaggerated to identify, to the extent she did, with a house. I'd studied drawings of it, but nevertheless, nothing made sense until I saw it and wandered about inside, the bats swooping in the kitchen. While she was living for a short time in Egypt, she wrote that in her dreams she was always imagining she was in Menabilly, hallucinating almost, so that when she woke up and found she was not, she was sick with disappointment and a strange kind of grief. The house, without a doubt, fueled her imagination, her love for it burning through her work.
And tomorrow, as illness strikes, the London family house becomes something of a refuge, as Sean Thomas continues reading My Life in Houses by Margaret Forster. It was abridged by Sally Marmion and produced by Justine Willett. After the news, Jenny Murray will be here with Woman's Hour.
Hal. Hal, let's switch to Radio 4, please. Hal, can we listen to Radio 4? Hal, switch to Radio 4, please.
The story behind Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey in BBC Radio 4's film programme. This afternoon at 4. And then online for 30 days.